Kierkegaard and His Culture, Part 2, was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 26, 2003, at Art Project's Spring Conference on Kierkegaard in Art Making. Art Project is an institute of Gutenberg College.
The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
Just a reminder of how the schedule is working, how we've designed the conference. We're dedicating these first couple of sessions to letting Jack lay out a picture of how he sees Kierkegaard and his relevance to Christian faith, and comment along the way on the potential for artists. At the end of this session, we'll have a time for some questions and answers with Jack. And then the afternoon, after lunch, is if Jack doesn't quite get through all the time he needs this morning, we're going to actually give him a little more time in the early afternoon and then dedicate our afternoon time to really to an in-depth dialogue, question-answer, and bringing in the issues of, well, as an artist, how would I think about this, or bringing in some of the arts questions that are related to this. So, go for it.
I consulted our other Kierkegaard expert, Megan, over the break, and I have not read Sickness Unto Death, but Megan says that Sickness Unto Death is one of those books, in answer to your question, that emphasizes the need for God to carry us because of our sin and inadequacy. So I didn't know that because I hadn't read that book, but it does not surprise me. I mean, he's too good of a Bible student to have missed that theme in the New Testament. Also, let me define existentialism, because I think some people are confused by that. The most important thing to realize, the professor who taught the class on existentialism really helped me a lot with this. This made a lot of sense to me. And he argued that existentialism is not a school of thought. It's not a worldview. It's not a set of ideas. Typically we think of, when you categorize a philosophy, you're categorizing it by the content of that philosophy, the content of the beliefs of a person who believes that. So a rationalist has a certain view of knowledge, or a behaviorist has a certain view of the relationship between the mind and the body. And so it's the answers that they give to a question that's defining the label or the title. Existentialism is different. Existentialism doesn't define the answers that you give to certain philosophical questions. It rather defines the set of philosophical questions that are interesting to you. So, an existentialist like Kierkegaard is going to give very, very, very different answers to those questions than an existentialist like Nietzsche or Sartre. What makes them the same is not their view of reality and their view of truth and their view of the world. What makes them the same is the set of questions that they emphasize in their so-called philosophy. When most people, especially in Christian circles, talk about existentialism, what they mean is Sartrean existentialism, not Kierkegaardian existentialism. And Sartrean existentialism, his worldview was, there is no truth. In fact, you sometimes wonder if there's any objective reality for Sartre. There is no truth, there is no objective reality. We just believe whatever, we just choose whatever we choose the values we choose the beliefs that we choose, and we make for ourselves our reality. Well, you can see why calling Kierkegaard an existentialist, if what you think existentialism is what Sartre had to say, is very, very confusing. Because that's not at all Kierkegaard's view of life. Kierkegaard very, very clearly and decisively believes that there is an objective truth, There is an objective reality. There is a right and there is a wrong. God is the right choice for a human being to make. To choose against God is folly, is foolishness. There's no question about that. But what Kierkegaard wants to emphasize is, as right as it is to choose God, you as a human individual have the freedom to be foolish. You have the freedom to choose against him rather than for him. And it's that emphasis on the freedom of my choice to define my own life and existence and to make my own way that he shares that emphasis in common with someone like Sartre. So yes, they equally emphasize freedom, but their worldview couldn't be further apart. They are on different planets in terms of their answers they give to those questions. So I hope that's clear. Another issue that came up is I should probably comment on the difficulty of reading Kierkegaard. One of Kierkegaard's devices is to, you know, remember I outlined the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious stage of life. One of Kierkegaard's devices is to explore each of those from inside. So he writes one work completely of the viewpoint of someone who actually is an aesthetic, who is actually looking at life that way and living like that life that way and pursuing life that way. You read that, if that's the first thing you read of Kierkegaard, you know, you read that and you go, wow, and they call him a Christian? I mean, what is this? Well, that's not his, he's not, in Either Or, for example, you know, when he writes from the point of view of an aesthetic, he's just laying that out for you and saying, well, here's what it would be like. Here's what life would be like lived this way. Then he takes the ethical point of view. Here's what life would be like lived this way. In Either Or, he doesn't deal with the religious particularly, but just those two. And as the title of the book suggests, he's laying them both out for you from the inside and then saying, you choose. It's your choice. Whatever you decide to make your life, it's going to be either this or it's going to be this. I remember my nephew took a class at the U of O where they read a work within Either Or called The Diary of the Seducer. The Diary of the Seducer is this diary of this guy who basically seduces this young woman and then immediately after a sexual encounter dumps her. And the whole thing is clearly showing how he is consciously and deliberately and purposefully just teasing the girl and, for that matter, teasing himself in the process to try to prolong as much as possible the suspense and the drama to stave off the boredom. You know, what the aesthete needs to do is to keep life interesting and keep life exciting and whatever it takes to do that. Well, it's a despicable work. I mean, you can't help, if you have a moral bone in your body, you can't help but hate this guy for what, because it is so crassly exploitive and manipulative and shallow. I mean, there's just no question about it. Well, imagine that's your introduction to Kierkegaard. You go, this is awful. I mean, my nephew just came over fuming. I hate Kierkegaard. I just can't stand this guy. But you have to know my nephew. You have to read all of his works in the context of his life work to really understand what he's doing. And what he's doing is saying, can you live that way? Yeah, you can live that way. That's the choice before you. But in the same work, he has these passages by this correspondence between this older man and this younger man about the ethical, about living ethically. And wonderful, compelling passages about how much more substantial and real and profound it is to pursue the ethical over the aesthetic. And I think I find them just spine-chilling because they're spine-tingling, because they're so compelling. It's wonderful stuff. And he's just laying them out there and saying, you choose. You make up your mind which you want your life to be about. Let's see, there was a third question. No, I guess that's it. Okay. Now, I don't know how this happened, but there's another element of the essence of authentic faith that should have been on my notes, and it my computer cut it. It's my computer's fault. Not only is the authentic faith a religious commitment to God or to the infinite, but it's a passionate commitment to the infinite. And I left that off. It's not detached, tentative, what he calls objective. He's a real enemy of objectivity, and we'll need to explore that a little bit further, what he means by that. It's not guarded, tentative, objective, an intellectual assent to Christianity. It's a passionate commitment from the depths of one's being. He's trying to capture there what I think the New Testament means by the love of God. I mean, notice that in the New Testament, you go back and forth between belief in the truth, belief in the gospel being the mark of a child of God, and the love of God being the mark of a child of God. And the New Testament sees them as a part of the same reality, just two sides of the same reality. That's what Kierkegaard is trying to get at here. We're not committing ourselves to a set of ideas. We're not committing ourselves to theology. We're not committing ourselves to the objective truth about reality. We are loving the infinite. I don't know how else to define it, but what he's getting at, I think, is absolutely crucial. In order for the reality of what God is doing in our life to be real and to be authentic, it's not surface, it's not casual, it's not external. It's this deeply inward thing that involves this thing that he calls passion. I love the things of God, and I evidence that love for the things of God because it transforms my life. That's where Kierkegaard is very clearly misunderstood by a lot of people. It's in this context that he talks about the leap of faith. For the longest time, I thought that what Kierkegaard was saying by the leap of faith is that you come along trying to rationalize your faith, trying to intellectually comprehend your faith, but you can only get so far, and you can only become so persuaded that Christianity is true, and the level of persuasion that you can get is only what he calls an approximation. That is, you can't achieve certainty. Maybe Christianity is true, maybe it's not, but it looks like it might be true. That's as far as your mind is going to be able to get you. And so what you need to do in order to get to faith is to take this intellectual leap. You just decide, oh well, I believe. What criteria do you use? Is McIntyre in his argument, in his article in the Encyclopedia of Philosophy says, oh, there's no criteria, just arbitrary. You just decide to leap just because you decide to leap. There's no reason you decided to leap, you just decide to leap. The reason that's a misunderstanding is because what Kierkegaard is not talking about knowledge. He's not talking about epistemology. He's not talking about intellectual certainty. What Kierkegaard realizes is that even if you could come to absolutely 100% intellectual certainty that Jesus was who he said he was, that God exists and is real and is important and is the creator of reality and all that stuff, let's say you could come to sterling 100% certainty about all those relevant beliefs. He would say, so? It doesn't make you a believer. Because unless you've decided out of this passion that comes from inside to love God, to love the infinite, to love the things of God, then you're not a believer. You're not what the Bible calls a child of God. This is not authentic faith. And that's not a matter of degree. It's not a matter of becoming more certain. It's a matter of a whole different kind of issue. It's the issue of love versus knowledge. It's the issue of commitment versus intellectual assent. There's a lot of ways you could define the difference, but there's this fundamental qualitative difference between what we're called upon to do and what we are doing when we are just doing theology and doctrine and stuff like that. So that's what he means by his leap of faith, is that decision that I need to make finally to do this, to love God, to define my existence by God. And that my mind cannot help me with because it's not intellectual, it's volitional. It's a matter of being willing to do it, not a matter of being certain or knowing something. So because of that, Kierkegaard has a real disdain for the approach to Christianity that he saw around him, where he saw these people studying the faith, studying the Bible, studying doctrine, arguing about doctrine, trying to become more and more certain that it's true. And not, I would argue, that he has anything fundamentally against that as an enterprise. I don't think he would object to it as an enterprise. But what he objects to is that people are doing that instead of committing. And he sees it as a distraction, because, I mean, he sees it as a mask for our unbelief, because I can always not commit on the grounds that, well, I'm not sure yet. Let me just study one more thing here to make sure that this is true. And when I'm sure that this is true, then I will commit. And I think what Kierkegaard is saying to that is a big, loud, resounding, no, you won't. You're kidding yourself. You're lying to yourself. The degree of approximation that you've achieved is already plenty clear and sure enough for you to be faced with the question that God poses for your life. Will you love me or not? You already know that that's the question. You don't need to study more to confront that question. You already know that's the question. The reason that you haven't committed is not because you need to be sure that God is asking the question. The reason you haven't committed is because you don't want to. And that's what you have to decide. What you have to decide is that you want it. And that's a whole different ball of wax. That's a whole different issue than the intellectual question of how certain, how sure, how reliable is the truth of Christianity. That's not your problem, basically, is what he's saying. So that's that passion that he's looking for, that is volitional in nature and not intellectual in nature. Okay, let's go on here to the nature and reality of sin then. That's a big, important theme in Kierkegaard. It's this pretense that we have that we are not sinners, ultimately, that he is really outraged by and is trying to poke at in so many different ways. Sin is ultimately, I think, for him, alienation from the infinite, alienation from God and the things of God. And it comes very naturally to us. We do not love God, naturally speaking. We don't want God. We're not interested in doing business with God. As far as we're concerned, God can go to hell. We wish he would dry up and go away. That's the natural condition of a human heart. That has very important implications, I think, for, Kierkegaard would say, for the individual Christian and for Christendom. It means that we don't have a natural passion for the infinite, and yet we can't have authentic faith without that passion. So that does not come automatically. It's something that we must choose in our freedom. And as Megan suggested in Sickness Unto Death, that's something we need help with. Even to make that choice is ultimately going to be something that God will help us with. That also means if we don't have any passion for the infinite, we don't have any natural passion for ethics and obedience. That does not come naturally to us. He has a whole book called Purity of Heart, which is just, I just think it's wonderful. It's not one of his more accessible works, but as you begin to see what he's saying there, you know, basically what he's exploring is all the ways that the human heart deceives itself, all the ways in which impurity distorts, perverts, twists, turns our, tries to make our unrighteousness look righteous, when in fact it's not righteous at all. And then a very important theme in Kierkegaard that for the longest time I misunderstood is that because we are sinners, we naturally take offense at the very person of Jesus. He calls him the God-man Jesus. We take offense at that. When I was first introduced to Kierkegaard, I thought, based on other people's reading of Kierkegaard, that what he was saying is that what we're being called upon to do as Christians is to embrace a contradiction. That in Jesus, God has become man. That's virtually a logical contradiction, and we are to do the very noble, irrational thing of embracing a logical contradiction, an irrationality, and that there's some virtue in embracing the irrational. Again, I would argue that's a complete misconstruing what Kierkegaard is saying. That's not it at all. Kierkegaard lived in a day, keep this in mind, Kierkegaard lived in a day where the truth of Christianity was not in question. That's where we get confused, because we live in an environment where we take it for granted that whatever else is true, Christianity isn't really true. I mean, that much we all know in American culture, is that it's kind of nice, it's kind of quaint, a little old-fashioned in a cute sort of way. There's a lot of nobility in being a Christian and stuff, but let's not think it's true. That would be ridiculous. I mean, that's just taken for granted in our culture. And so, you know, we read someone like Kierkegaard as if he were confronting my culture, and one of the very, very basic fundamental things that we'd have to do is to argue for and establish the truth of Christianity. I think one of the reasons Kierkegaard was so attractive in my generation growing up in college is living in a culture that said Christianity is not true, Kierkegaard, they thought, gave us a way to believe it anyway and be intellectually respectable. Well, how do you believe it anyway and be intellectually respectable? Well, you embrace the irrational. You say, I know it's not true, but I have the strength of will to believe it anyway. And Kierkegaard says, that's cool. That's not what he's saying. He is not one whit interested in defending the truth of Christianity, because everyone around him knows it's true. That's not even an issue. What he's interested in doing is exploring the dynamics of real spirituality, of a real, what he calls, inwardness that's authentic in relationship to God, and that's an entirely different set of problems and issues. And why am I talking about that here? So when he talks about the God becoming man in Jesus, he doesn't see that as some sort of irrational irrational belief, but he sees it as an obnoxious belief to a human being, an offensive belief, an outrageous belief to a human being. Now, when I explore partly what he means by that, I really begin to resonate with that, because if you can do this thought experiment with me, he talks about how it's not offensive to think that God would become man. I mean, every Hegelian believed that God became mankind. And we're all content to believe that God became man, because, I mean, why wouldn't he want to? I mean, man. So that's not a problem. And it's not a problem to think that Jesus, if we think of Jesus as divine, as a godlike being, to be the unique God-man, because, well, sure, I mean, who better to be the God-man than God? That's not offensive. But what gets offensive is when we put ourselves in the sandals of Peter and John and so on, and we see this Galilean peasant who is no more qualified to be the God-man than I am, and what I mean by that is no more qualified from the standpoint of the bells and whistles of his being. He gets sleepy like I get sleepy. He gets hungry like I get hungry. When he's cut, he bleeds. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything about Jesus that sets him apart from me ontologically, in terms of the nature and kind of being that he has. He's just one more version of me. Well, all of a sudden, then, if you're anything like me, and maybe this tells me more about me than anything else, but if you're anything like me, if Jesus isn't any more qualified ontologically to be the God-man than I am, why didn't you choose me, God? Why him and not me? I mean, there's something in us, that sin in us, that self-centeredness, that tendency for all of us to see ourselves as the hero of cosmic history, that we all would love to believe about ourselves anyway. All of a sudden we recognize that there's this Galilean peasant who was brought into the world to be the hero of human history, and my response is, damn, why not me? And I think that's what Kierkegaard's getting at. That's the outrage, that's the offense of the God-man Jesus. I can't be authentically related to the infinite without being authentically related to the God-man, and I can't be authentically related to the God-man until I bow my knee to him as Lord of Lords, King of Kings, the center of God's creation, and that's really obnoxious because he didn't have anything going for him over me. And yet, Kierkegaard says, if you haven't first been offended by Jesus, then you don't really believe in Jesus. You believe in something else. You believe in the Jesus of the church. You believe in the Jesus of Christian history. You believe in this made-up fictional Jesus that Christendom has given to us. But we haven't believed in the real Jesus who really lived in history and who confronts every human being with the reality of his claims. You haven't believed in him. But that's not irrational to believe that. If he were to address it, he doesn't. Well, I, as far as I know, he doesn't. If he were to address it, I think he would address the issue of, well, how do you know he really is who he is, the same way the apostles did. He walked on water, he raised people from the dead, he turned water into wine. There's all kinds of rational evidences that his claim was a bona fide, valid claim for who he was. Is it logically possible that we're wrong about who Jesus is? Yeah. Is that why we don't believe? No, it's not why we don't believe. I don't lack evidence. I lack desire. And that's what I have to decide. And that's what Kierkegaard is trying to do in his writings, is to fan the desire, to infuse desire in people who don't otherwise have it. You know, to give us a vision for how wonderful it would be, how rich it would be, how rewarding it would be, how right it would be to be rightly related to our Creator. And we can either be infected by that desire or not. But that's what has to happen. People don't need to be persuaded to be Christians. The fire needs to be stoked for them to have the desire to be rightly related with God. And so his project is to stoke that fire literally in every way he can. But we don't naturally have that passion, and we naturally take offense at the God-man Jesus as a result of our sinfulness. That's a function of our self-centeredness that comes out of our sin. The other thing that's going to be inevitable is rejection by the age in which we live, no matter what that age is, the Bible would say, and I think Kierkegaard would agree. And even more controversially, we will be rejected by Christendom. The true and authentic believer is ultimately going to be alone. He's not going to be a part of a community. He's not going to be a part of Christendom, because Christendom isn't going to buy his commitments. His commitments are going to seem odd. They're going to seem threatening. They're going to seem destructive. They're going to seem subversive. There's just all kinds of qualities to authentic faith that makes Christendom, the culture of safe religion, very, very threatened by that faith. And therefore, Christendom will reject him and persecute him. A lot of people, I think there's some interpreters of Kierkegaard who see him as kind of a, how do they interpret him? It's kind of a whining, self-pitying genius who, because he was rejected by the church around him, was just sort of sucking his thumb. You could read him that way, but I think that's Nietzsche, not Kierkegaard. The implications for Christendom, there's this inevitable alienation between Christendom and the authentic Christian, the flip side of what I've just described. Christendom will inevitably persecute the authentic Christian. And then finally, and most importantly, Christendom is a substitute for and an enemy of authentic faith. because it's a way of it's a way to avoid making the commitment of true faith. It comes back to that mediation thing. If I can allow something to mediate my relationship with God, then I can let Christendom be the vehicle that makes me rightly related to the infinite. I can do business with Christendom, and then I don't have to do business with God. And it's a way of avoiding me ever having to face the issue, face the question, and make the decision that I need to make. So he sees it ultimately as very, very dangerous. That's where Kierkegaard, if you look at him and take him seriously, this is going to be very controversial, because there are, you know, many of us in this day and age who would look at Kierkegaard saying that kind of thing and think, you're just being hysterical here. Church ain't that bad. You know, may not be all that you want it to be, but it's not dangerous. It's not destructive. Church is a helpful little stepping stone to God. Kierkegaard is taking a different view, I think. He's saying, actually, to the contrary, it's a counterfeit. It's a substitute for what we really need to do. Is that I need to make a decision in the loneliness of my individuality. Okay. Then there are these further elements of authentic faith. They may not be in and of themselves essential to what faith is, but to understand Kierkegaard, it's important to see these other elements that he explores. First one is the absurdity of faith. I've already sort of begun to speak to that issue. The absurdity of it is not the irrationality of it. That's not what he means by that. But rather, it's the fact that a faith that strikes me and my culture as sort of reasonable and useful and helpful and of benefit, that's not an authentic faith. An authentic faith is going to appear to the culture around me, the world around me, and even the church that I'm in. It's going to appear as fanatical, crazy, suicidal, bizarre, outlandish. It's not going to be well received. It's the being a fool for Christ sort of idea. I can't really be a disciple of Christ if I'm not willing to be perceived by the world around me as a fool, because authentic faith inevitably will have to be perceived in that way. There's the offensiveness of faith. A faith that is attractive and acceptable to my culture and to me is not an authentic faith. And we've already talked about with the outrage of Jesus, and as Megan says, God, I should find it outrageous that I'm making this commitment to the infinite and be put off by it rather than attracted to it. Third thing is the subjectivity of faith. This needs some explanation. He poses the subjectivity as over against the objectivity. This is already implicit in stuff I've already explained, but let me just explain his vocabulary. By subjective, he means personal and volitional, coming from me, the subject, coming from me, the person having to do business with God. And it's a commitment of me, the subject's very being, to what is right and good and true, committing the entirety of my existence. As opposed to an objective faith would be measured and detached assessment that the evidence supports Christianity as being true. So it's just what I was describing earlier. Faith being subjective means I don't get there by persuading myself incrementally more and more, becoming more and more certain of the faith. You can't get there that way. There's this radical disjunction. I just need to decide, based on the evidence that I do have before me, which I think Kierkegaard would say is plenty, you know, is plenty compelling enough. We know Christianity must be true. That's not the issue. The issue is, will I, the subject, commit to it? And so that's the subjectivity. So when he writes in the concluding unscientific postscript, when he writes, truth is subjectivity, that sounds very confusing, because it sounds like he's laying out his epistemology. Sounds like he's laying out his definition of truth. Truth is what you make it to be. You know, truth is what you decide that it is. The classic modern postmodern idea what's true for you is true for you, and my truth is my truth, and your truth is your truth, and never the twain shall meet. That's not at all where Kierkegaard is coming from. He's not even talking about epistemology when he says truth is subjectivity. What he's talking about is to a culture that says we have the truth, we are in possession of the truth, to that Kierkegaard is saying, no, you don't. All you have done is objectively satisfied yourself intellectually that this is true rather than false. Okay, you've done that. But to be in possession of the truth has to involve subjectivity. And without that, you're in possession of nothing. You don't got nothing. You don't have the faith if you have not approached it from the inside and subjectively. That brings us to the next one, what he calls the inwardness of faith. And by that, he in part means the subjectivity of faith, I think, but he means more than that. It's this classic distinction that you see in the New Testament between the believer and the hypocrite. Because Kierkegaard is keenly aware of how we go through the motions so that externally, on the outward, we look like someone who believes, when in fact, inwardly, there is no belief there at all. His favorite way of describing that is mimicking dance, where the moves of a dancer, the one who's living externally is someone who simply goes through the motions of the dance. But while they're going through the motions of the dance, such that they look like a dancer on the outside, but it doesn't go beyond the motions. It doesn't go any deeper than the motions. Somebody told them move this way and they moved that way. But so they moved that way. What is the commitment of their hearts? It's not the dance, the outward motions are not coming from within, they're just plastered on the outside. And that's one of his most profound insights. I mean, it's not original to him, obviously. The New Testament is exploring that as well. But it's one of the most profound things that any of us need to grasp if we're going to understand true spirituality. That there is this thing called inwardness. There is this thing deep down inside that defines me in a way that all of my actions can never define me. And don't make the mistake of taking the outward to simply be outward actions. I mean, outwardness can be at the level of psychology and attitudes as well. I mean, I was, growing up in my background, we knew very well that it wasn't enough that you did a kindness. You needed to mean it as a kindness. Well, what does it mean to mean it as a kindness? Your attitudes have to be right, right? You have to feel the appropriate things. You have to believe the appropriate things. You have to think about it the right way, view it in exactly the right way. And so part of what we were all trained to do in fundamentalist spirituality was to slap on to our psychology and our emotions, the right psychology and the right emotions. Do the motions of the dance. Do the dance right. And that some of that may seem very inward, very interior kind of stuff that we're doing. But from the standpoint of what Kierkegaard is talking about, all of that is still not inward yet. Even that is not inward. Even though you're dealing with interior psychology, you're still just slapping stuff on the outside of your existence. It hasn't arisen from and been defined by the deepest, central, most commitments of your heart. And because of that, it's not authentic. It's a very profound concept, but it's impossible to define in any other way unless you have seen the difference in your own life. If you don't know the difference between inward and outwardness, I don't think Kierkegaard can help you. But if you see the difference that he's talking about, it's incredibly insightful and incredibly profound. And it comes back to the question raised earlier about where does God play into all this? The inwardness that Kierkegaard is describing is something that ultimately, from a biblical perspective, only God can produce and only God can do. Because the minute you can do it, then it's not inward, it's outward, it's external. The minute you can do it, you're just slapping it on this outside. You're just going through the motions. You're just following the script that somebody wrote for you. You know, what does it mean to love God? Well, it looks like this, 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 and this. So how do I love God? Well, I do this, 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 and this. But Kierkegaard would say, well, you did this, 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 and this. The problem is you don't love God. Because love of God is not doing that. Those things simply arrive out of that, arise out of that as a reality. And if they are reflective of the reality that's really there, then that's authentic. But if they're just mimicking that which exists in other people authentically, that's just hypocrisy. That's just outwardness, not inwardness. Very, very important idea, I think. Then he has this concept of faith as moral striving. We are always constantly in process of becoming what we are committed to being. We have not arrived, and we have not arrived, and we will not arrive in this life. We are always in the course of becoming that. And so what does that translate into? Striving morally to be the ethical, good, righteous, obedient person that the reality of God requires of me. And that becomes an essential aspect of faith for him. And again, a very, I think, a crucial one to understand. We don't understand faith if we ignore that. Most of my Christian life, morality always struck me as a kind of afterthought to my faith. I couldn't figure out what morality had to do with anything. I mean, Jesus took care of all that on the cross. And I didn't have to be good to be saved. I didn't have to be good to have eternal life. I mean, faith was what it was all about. And stuff like that. And, oh, if God had a preference, he'd rather I be good or bad. Yeah, but it's not essential. You know, whether you are or not, we're saved by faith, not by work. So, you know, it doesn't really make any difference. Well, one of the things that really resonated with me when I got back reacquainted with Kierkegaard is because one of the things in studying the New Testament that had grown in my understanding over those 20 years was how integral righteousness, godliness, morality was to the love of God. You can't love God without loving who he is. You can't love God without loving the goodness and the righteousness and the godliness that characterizes him. So there's no way in the world that you can divorce faith and morality and righteousness. And that's very, very compellingly laid out, I think, in Kierkegaard. Faith is the acknowledgement of personal sinfulness. I mentioned how so much of what he does is aimed at popping the bubble of our presumption and our self-delusion. And most importantly, he thinks, it's at the level of my acknowledgement of personal sin. We do everything we can to avoid that judgment about ourselves. We try to avoid the acknowledgement that I am a sinner. And Kierkegaard says that's the fundamental problem with Christendom. The fundamental problem with Christendom is that they don't acknowledge the foundational reality of their own sinfulness. And yet that is basic to what it means to be rightly related to the infinite. Faith is a response to the divine imperative. The very being of God, the very fact that God is there as the infinite, demands a response of me. And that demand is the fundamental demand that every individual human being needs to confront. We must not avoid that demand. We must not divert our attention from that demand. We must face that demand and answer it one way or the other. We can answer it by saying, no, I'm not going to embrace you, or by saying, yes, I will embrace you. But we gotta face it. We gotta face the question. And faith is simply responding appropriately to that imperative. And then finally, he very, very effectively and poignantly pursues the notion of faith as a pursuit of the eternal within the temporal. In Fear and Trembling, he has a passage where he talks about, he makes a distinction between the night of faith, K-N-I-G-H-T, and the night of what he calls infinite resignation. And if I understand what he's saying, the night of infinite resignation is the person who, in their pursuit of the eternal, in their pursuit of the infinite, they have decided to forsake the finite, forsake the temporal. And they have resigned themselves to not being able to live in the temporal. They have resigned themselves to not be able to be satisfied with the finite. So they are so completely given over and preoccupied with the eternal and the infinite. Basically, what Kierkegaard is saying is that that's just pretentious drivel. That's just a counterfeit. That's a way of pretending like you're committed to the infinite. That's not a real, authentic commitment to the infinite. Because the knight of faith, the one who is really committed to the infinite and the eternal, is committed to the eternal in the context of the finite and in the context of the temporal. They don't forsake the temporal, they transform it. They don't forsake the finite, they transform it. And he describes then, immediately following that, he likens, again using the metaphor of dance, he likens the night of infinite resignation as a dancer who leaps into the air, forgive my ignorance about dance, but some kind of dance leap into the air and stays there. Whereas the night, and I think what the air represents for him is this distance from this world, this distance from the temporal, the separation from the ground that we walk on and live on. The night of infinite resignation stays there. The night of faith leaps into the air and touches down again on the ground and does so all so gracefully that you don't even know they ever left the ground. I don't know what that would look like, but I understand the symbolism of that. The symbolism of that is they have indeed committed themselves to something beyond this world. They have indeed done that. They have made that leap. But they have made that leap in a way that you don't know that they've made that leap, because they live life here in the here and now in the temporal and the finite exactly the same way the rest of us do. In fact, they can match the life of the most committed aesthete, the most committed hedonist. They can be a hedonist right along with the most committed hedonist, and you can't tell the difference. That's not true. I mean, you can tell the difference. It has been transformed, but the difference is subtle enough that it won't be obvious to you unless you see enough of their life. And then he tells the story about a man who works as a job as an accountant or bookkeeper or something like that. I don't remember what he is. And as he's sitting there at his desk, he starts thinking about tonight he wants to have, I think it's lamb's head or sheep's head or something like that. Sounds awful to me, but anyway, he starts drooling over the sumptuous feast of lamb's head or something like that that his wife is going to fix him tonight. And I mean, what he's trying to portray is this person who can really enjoy the sensory experience of tasting a delicious dish. And he's really excited about this. And he, after work, he heads home and he stops off at the pub and he has a round of ale with his friends and they have a rip-roaring good time of conversation and smoking their pipes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then after the happy hour, he leaves and heads home and he gets home and his wife informs him that she didn't have enough money for the sheep's head or whatever it is, and they're having, I don't know, porridge instead. I mean, I don't know what they're having instead. And the key to the whole thing is, I can't remember how it goes in Danish, but he's cool with that. That's fine. The aesthete, I think his point is, the aesthete's life has been ruined if he doesn't get the sensory experience that he's wanting, that he's desiring, that his life is defined by. Then his life is ruined. The knight of faith can take it or leave it, because the knight of faith doesn't define his life by his sensory experience and by sensuality. He can enjoy it if it's there, but if it's not there, that's okay. My life is not about the sensory. My life is about the eternal. And so nothing lost, really. I was very struck years and years ago when the movie Chariots of Fire came out. Some of you have heard me use this before, but this was very striking to me, that in the story of Chariots of Fire, if you remember, it's the story of these two Olympic athletes from England who are going to the Paris Olympics. And one of them is a child of a Presbyterian missionary, and the other one is a Jew. And they're both runners. As it turns out, the race that they both run is, and they were competing against each other, the race that they are both to run is scheduled by the Olympics for Sunday, which to a staunch Presbyterian Calvinist is the Sabbath, and he dare not run on that day. So he decides, I can't run. I'm not going to run. This has been his lifelong passion, you know, to get a gold medal at the Olympics. But the temporal and the eternal have come into conflict for him. In order, in his own way, given his own belief system, given his own doctrinal commitments, to run on the Sabbath would be to violate the eternal. And he cannot violate the eternal for something merely temporal, so he lets go of the temporal. He's willing to not get it. As it turns out, they rearrange things and decide to put him in a different event that is not run on the Sabbath, so he is entered in another event instead. He runs that event and he gets a gold medal. This Jew, Howard Abramson, whatever his name is, runs in the initial event and he too gets a gold medal. But what is really interesting is the way the movie portrays their response to their respective gold medals. Thoroughly enjoys the achievement of having received the gold medal. This Jewish runner, sprinter, is in utter despair and completely depressed after having done so. And if I understand what the movie is trying to do, is to suggest that Eric Little's life was not defined by his running. There's one point in the movie where he says, "When I run, I feel the pleasure of God." And he's running for the glory of God. I mean, that there's something beyond the temporal that is defining his existence and is defining his life. Because something beyond the temporal is defining his existence and is defining his life, he can thoroughly enjoy the temporal. He can take it for what it is, enjoy what is there to be enjoyed, delight in what is there to be delighted, and if it's taken away, oh well, it's not there for me. He was willing to give it up entirely in order to be obedient to his God. This other man is the aesthete in Kierkegaard's perspective. He was defining his life by this achievement of being the fastest man in the world. That defined his existence. He achieved it. He got there. Now what? Now where do we go? I've got it, and oh well, no big deal. And he's completely crushed, completely in despair, completely despondent over this achievement. I think it was just an incredible, incredible movie to capture that difference between what the freedom that we have to enjoy this world when we don't make too much of this world, and the utter despair that comes when we try to make this world our salvation and to make it our reward and to make it our fulfillment and to actually have it define my existence. It can only disappoint me. It can only fail me. But if I don't try to make this world define my existence, then I can utterly and thoroughly delight in it and enjoy it. That, I think, is exactly what Kierkegaard is trying to say in Fear and Trembling. That's what the Knight of Faith has realized, is that he pursues the eternal in the very context of the temporal context in which God has put me in this world. And because I'm not pursuing anything but the eternal, I am totally and utterly free to enjoy it and to delight in it to the degree that it's there. But I'm also equally free to forego it and be without it, have it be taken away from me and ripped out of my hands. And that's fine too, because it's not that big a deal in the end. I think Kierkegaard explores that very effectively. So let me look at some observations about how Kierkegaard actually did his project. I've talked about some of this, but he didn't use the conceptual vocabulary of the Bible, at least not in a significant part of his work. He instead used the conceptual vocabulary of the popular intellectual culture of his day, the Hegelianism of his day. He drew heavily on that, so much so that some philosopher, some history of people in the history of ideas would say that he was influenced by Hegel. I don't think that's really true. He was simply using his vocabulary. But he was changing and subverting its meaning to make it say what the Bible says, not what Hegel said, and to convey a completely different worldview. But what's key about Kierkegaard is I think he did so without actually changing and distorting and perverting the biblical truth. It really was the biblical truth that he was conveying. There are other people who've tried to come up with a fresh take on Christianity, find new vocabulary, new ways of conveying it, new ways of expressing it, and so on. But the project fails, I think, because what they end up doing is inventing a new religion, you know, inventing a new philosophy, inventing a new way of looking at life. They're not, and I think the problem is they are not the Bible students that Kierkegaard is. They're not grounded in biblical truth, and because they're not grounded in biblical truth, they're just kind of set free to roll their own Christianity. This whole emphasis today on let's be postmodern in our approach to Christianity, let's not be bound to the tired, you know, outmoded ways of conveying our faith and practicing our faith and so on and so forth. As noble as that sounds and as noble as that is in its basic essential spirit, the problem is the people, it seems to me, who are trying to do that are not grounded in biblical faith enough to be able to pull that off. They end up conveying a whole different view of God, a whole different view of faith, a whole different view of truth, a whole different view of everything. They invent a new religion. You can't just get rid of the organ and bring the guitar into the church and make it hip. That doesn't cut it. You need to be grounded in the old-fashioned original truth of Christianity that is going to be hated by the culture, it's going to be rejected by the world, it's going to be rejected by Christendom. You need to be grounded in that and committed to that, and then, tethered to that as you are, then find a way to convey that in fresh new language and vocabulary. But if you're not tethered there first, you're just going to wander off and invent a new religion. Kierkegaard used what he called indirect communication at times, and I'm not prepared to do this, but for those of you who are interested, I think it would probably be worth studying and evaluating what he meant by that, what he thought he was doing, and why he was doing it. I think that would be a very worthy study for any of you who are in art making and who are wanting to try to get in the back door of culture to edify our culture. I think there may be a rich resource here in Kierkegaard to find out what did he do and how did he think about what he was doing. In part, I think that his reason for that is that Kierkegaard saw the tendency of Christian thinkers to produce a system, produce a philosophy, a set of ideas that they then presented to the world for the world's admiration. Kierkegaard refused to do that. In the beginning, that is just, if you don't like sarcasm, you won't like Kierkegaard. I mean, he's just sharply sarcastic. But in his opening of the Unconcluding Scientific Proscript, he says that what I'm really afraid is going to happen is the world will come marching to my door and, you know, hoist me up on his shoulders and we'll march down the street. Cheering me as a, he says, I'm really, really afraid of that. He's partly being sarcastic, but there's some real truth to what he's saying there, and that is he realizes that a system of ideas is more likely to be about me, not about edification. I mean, why would I produce a theology, a philosophy, a new approach to the faith that I take out on the circuit and offer seminars and teach and so on and so forth? You know, he's aware enough of the BS of human existence to realize that that's not about edifying people. You're just wanting to draw attention to yourself. You're just wanting to exalt yourself. You're just trying to puff yourself up. That's what that's all about. That's what systems do. So he wasn't about building this. And here you see the influence of Socrates. Socrates did the same thing. So in Socrates, you have this whole dialogue devoted to how worthless writing is. And Socrates didn't write anything down. Socrates wrote on human hearts, not on paper. That is to say, he saw his job. He says, my mother was a midwife, and I followed her profession. You know, I'm a midwife. That his job was to give birth to truth in a person. I want to give birth to a commitment to what is true, an understanding of what is true in your heart, in your soul, in your being. That's how you help people. To write a speech is done in order to bring glory to me, the speechwriter, or me, the speech giver. So Socrates was not about that, because what's the point of that? The point is to bring other people to give birth in their soul to truth and a love of truth. Kierkegaard, I think, saw himself in much the same light as Socrates in that regard. My job, through this dialectical method of I lay this out there and I lay this out there, and I say, you're caught in the tension of this choice that you have to make. What's it going to be? What's the choice you're going to make? And the real benefit of what he's doing would be if someone out there reading his stuff would somehow make the right choice, having been inflamed to do so by the way in which he presented the choice to them and presented the alternatives to them. Edifying to that person. I think that's a real challenge for those of you in our culture today in art making, is we have all kinds of messages thrown at us every day that the whole point of being an artist, the whole point of engaging in art making and the artistic culture, is to make a name for yourself. It's to draw attention to yourself, to receive glory and the acclaim of the critics or of some audience somewhere. But that's the whole point of doing art, right? Well, I think Kierkegaard would challenge that. The point of doing anything in human existence, really, if we're going to be doing something for the infinite and not for the finite, the whole point of doing anything is to bring other people into right relationship to the infinite. And that's an individual, personal thing for them, and I can only try to reach inside into their inwards and inflame the fire of passion in them. That's the only valuable thing I can do. And that you can do invisibly, in secret, unacknowledged, not bringing attention to yourself, not bringing glory to yourself. And in fact, it probably is the only way to do it right, is to not seek to bring glory to yourself. Was Kierkegaard successful in his project? Well, that's a good question. Look how readily he's been misunderstood. He's been more misunderstood than understood. So if you look at it from the standpoint of world history, one could say, no, basically it was a dismal failure. He spawned Sartre and Sartrean existentialism, not Christianity, didn't promote Christianity. I can say that on the one hand. On the other hand, how many isolated, lonely individuals were there throughout time, like me, who got a hold of his works and really connected, really understood what he was facing me with, the choice he was facing me with, and was inspired to make that choice? Well, I don't know that we can know. But that's how he would have measured his success. That's how he would have measured the success of his project, not what he did in the scope of world history. That was of little concern to him, I think. Or at least he knew it should be of little concern in any case. Can we modern artists, art makers, I should say you, modern artists, art makers, make Kierkegaard's project our project? Well, yes, I think so. In the presence of sin and the urgent need of individuals to choose the eternal is universal and transcultural. It's always been the issue. It always will be the issue in human existence. There's never been a culture in which those have not been the realities that we need to confront as human beings. So in that sense, our project, it seems to me, if we want to do our art for the sake of the infinite and not for the sake of the finite, Kierkegaard's project needs to be our project. I think we can take Kierkegaard's strategy seriously to translate biblical truth into different conceptual vocabulary and therefore subvert it in order to convey the biblical message. I think we have something to learn from him, and I think that would be a very wise and prudent thing for us to do in our age. I don't think we have to do that. My life project is not to do that. My life project is just to understand the Bible and to learn its vocabulary and to learn its language and to understand it. But I'm handicapped by that, because when I come to explain the faith to people, I am so immersed in the vocabulary of the Bible that I'm going to use the vocabulary of the Bible in conveying that. And I realize that's a foreign language to people in our culture. And I'm speaking a foreign language and I'm cut off from them and I can't speak to them. So not being as clever and as creative as Kierkegaard, I'm stuck with speaking that foreign language, and so I have a double task before me. I need to teach you the language and then talk to you about the faith. But I'll take that on. I will try to teach you the language of the Bible, and then let me convey to you the gospel in the language of the Bible. And that's the only language I know, so that's the only way I can go. But some of the rest of you have the creativity and the ingenuity and the imagination that Kierkegaard had and may very well be able to translate this into other terms, and I would applaud you and encourage you and suggest that I think you have, in doing so, you have the potential to being far more effective in our world than I ever could be, and would encourage you to try that. But with the proviso that you can only do that if you are first and foremost Bible students, just as Kierkegaard was, so that you yourself are grounded and tethered to the truth. So that's the proviso, and the other proviso is we live in a different time, in a different age from Kierkegaard. We can no longer assume the objective truth of Christianity as he could and as he did. We do have another task before us, and that is somehow we not only need to convey the subjective reality of an authentic faith in Jesus, but we also have to persuade people of the objective truth of Christianity. We have that dual task before us, and something that Kierkegaard didn't even need to take on and didn't take on. And can you do both at the same time? I don't know. You know, that's something for you creative artist types to figure out.